This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, health authorities to decide whether the risk of rare blood clots will change Australia's vaccine strategy. Also, the government's delayed action on a major report on sexual misconduct. Will its in-principle response to some recommendations do the job? And noting the problem starts with disrespect, the Prime Minister points to social media as draining society's, quote, reservoirs of respect. Prominent feminist Jane Carrow joins us.
We're actually demanding the respect we've never had before, and you're hearing our voices in large numbers, yes, in those marches and things, all of which were organised on social media.
Good to have you with us today. Australia is mulling whether to place age restrictions on the AstraZeneca vaccine if health authorities adopt Europe's advice, linking it to an extremely rare but potentially fatal form of blood clotting. It's believed to affect up to 5 people in 1 million who receive the jab and appears to be more prominent in young adults, prompting the UK to urge anyone under 30 to seek an alternative to AstraZeneca. But health experts stress potentially dangerous side effects are common for most medications, and they say vaccine hesitancy could pose a much bigger risk. David Lipson has our report.
Australia's vaccine rollout is now within a whisker of its first major milestone, 1 million doses.
A national total now of 996,145 doses administered.
But the Health Minister Greg Hunt, who you just heard, is now confronting yet another challenge regarding the linchpin of Australia's vaccination program. The European Medicines Agency has found a possible link between the AstraZeneca vaccine and a very rare but dangerous form of blood clotting, which seems to be more prominent the younger you are. The UK is advising anyone under 30 to seek an alternative product.
I think it's probably been inappropriate for some of our leaders earlier on in this case to talk about the vaccine as 100% safe.
That's Dr. Jonathan Karapetis, a professor at the University of Western Australia, who sits on the federal government's COVID-19 Health and Research Advisory Committee.
Well, it is a very safe vaccine, but that doesn't mean that occasionally some incredibly rare side effects occur.
From the data available, it seems the clotting can form in the brain, lungs, and abdominal organs up to 2 weeks after receiving the vaccine, causing persistent pain and, in some cases, death.
Well, this is not your common and garden blood clot. Probably it's an immune-mediated damage to the platelets, which are the tiny particles in your blood that help to clot your blood. And that damage not only reduces the number of platelets, which can actually cause bleeding, but it makes them more sticky, and that can cause these very, very rare types of blood clots.
The fact it's extremely rare bears repeating, especially when compared to the benefits of the vaccine in staving off the ravages of COVID-19, as the Prime Minister Scott Morrison was at pains to point out.
In the UK, the advice is that some 6,000 people's lives have already been saved by this very vaccine. So we need to consider the positive benefits of them. But what we're looking at here is an incidence of this clotting behaviour of some 1 to 5 for every million.
Australian health authorities are now combing through the data, and Health Minister Greg Hunt says their recommendations will determine the government's response.
If they provide age restrictions or other variations, we'll do it. We'll adopt it.
Age restrictions would see younger Australians provided with an alternative vaccine. But for now, there's not as many options here as a country like the UK, because Australia's been heavily reliant on the local production of AstraZeneca to get needles in arms. And so the Health Minister's been shoring up the promised supply from overseas, with Novavax expected to arrive between July and September, and Pfizer's product still landing regularly.
I've got to say they have been utterly reliable in their delivery volumes and delivery dates. We have 20 million Pfizer, which are due in Australia during the course of 2021. We have reconfirmed that in the last 24 hours.
Peter Collignon, a professor of infectious diseases at the Australian National University, says the good news is that most younger Australians aren't due to get a vaccine for several months.
By the time that age group comes up to be in our lineup for vaccination, we will know better whether it's worth giving that vaccine to those people or to others, because by that time, I think we will have, you know, the ability to have imported more vaccine from some of the contracted suppliers overseas.
Professor Collignon points to a danger likely far greater than rare blood clotting: vaccine hesitancy.
I think that's a big risk. For instance, in some areas in Europe, even though they had a lot of uncontrolled COVID spread, they stopped vaccination in everyone. Now, that may have saved possibly one or two, you know, deaths from complications, and you could argue with that, but it probably caused thousands of deaths from people who weren't vaccinated.
Professor Peter Collignon speaking with David Lipson. It's been revealed this afternoon that the woman who made a historical allegation of rape against the former Attorney General Christian Porter asked New South Wales Police to conduct an interview via Skype 2 months before her death. The information was provided in answers to the State Parliament, where police revealed the woman contacted detectives on the 1st of April 2020 to request the Skype interview. Catherine Robinson's here. She's been following the story. Hi, Kath. How did this information come to light?
Linda, this information was tabled in New South Wales Parliament today, and their answers to questions that the New South Wales Police Commissioner Mick Fuller took on notice when he faced a budget estimates committee last month, or a month or so ago. Now, the new information is that the now deceased woman contacted detectives from Strike Force Wundara, that's the operation set up to manage her allegation, on the 1st of April 2020, requesting that Skype interview. Now, the alleged offence took place in Sydney, but the woman was in Adelaide. Now, this is an allegation that Christian Porter strenuously denies, but the issue of them being in different states, being the investigators and the woman, made it difficult for detectives to meet her face-to-face, particularly during the pandemic. New South Wales Police say that the woman was presented options with regards to a statement, but a joint decision by all parties was made not to conduct this interview remotely. Now, the New South Wales Greens MP, David Shoebridge, says a Skype statement, while not perfect, should have been taken.
Well, nobody would suggest that the first option is to have the interview conducted by video conference. But I have spoken with experienced investigators, police investigators, who have looked at historical sexual assault crimes. And they're very clear that if that's the only option you have available to you and the complainant wants that to happen, well, then you make the best of it. You actually support the complainant, the victim and the survivor, by taking the statement when they are ready to give the statement.
David Shoebridge there. So, Kath, what are New South Wales Police saying about why the statement wasn't taken?
Well, at budget estimates last month, the New South Wales Police Commissioner, Mick Fuller, told politicians that the woman had a positive relationship with investigators even after she'd been informed police weren't able to come to South Australia to take her statement, but that taking a statement via Skype was fraught with difficulties.
A historic sexual assault statement is one that is extremely complicated. It is not a simple statement. It is not something that you would do justice taking it over the phone. And there's still the challenges of putting it in a statement admissible form and sending that and having it signed, which could possibly be done. But they are complex investigations.
That was the New South Wales Police Commissioner Mick Fuller speaking a month or so ago. Now, Linda, I also spoke with a former New South Wales Police prosecutor, Patrick Schmidt, who says recording an interview like this is difficult for numerous reasons. He says it's quite impersonal. There's also no support there potentially for the victims, but he was also concerned about the providence of such a statement, which could be attacked or at least vulnerable, amongst other things.
And the other problem that the investigators have is how to gauge the actual questions. When you're sitting with someone, you get a lot of keys from reactions.
So, Linda, important to note that Mr. Porter, who now holds the industry and science portfolio, has strenuously denied the allegations made by the woman and has sued the ABC for defamation. But this is all far from over. New South Wales Greens MP David Shoebridge told me that he expects more information in the next 24 to 48 hours from New South Wales Police regarding Strike Force Wundara and their decision-making processes regarding record-keeping and travelling to South Australia to investigate this woman.
Okay, thanks very much, Kath. Catherine Robinson, our reporter there. Well, it's taken more than a year and a political crisis over the treatment of women. But today the federal government has responded to an internationally applauded report on how to address the scourge of workplace sexual harassment. Respect at Work, a forensic report done by the Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins, was handed to the Morrison government before the COVID pandemic. Its 55 recommendations aim to transform unsafe workplaces and make complaints processes clearer. The Prime Minister Scott Morrison has agreed to all of them, though on some recommendations it's only agreed in part or in principle. Political reporter Noor Haidar has the story.
Enough is enough! Enough is enough!
When thousands of women marched across the country last month, they wanted action. One of their top demands was for the federal government to fully implement the recommendations from the Respect at Work report. Scott Morrison today pledged that his government will adopt in whole, in part or in principle, the report's 55 recommendations.
Sexual harassment is unacceptable. It's not only immoral and despicable and even criminal, it denies Australians, especially women, not just their personal security, but their economic security.
The report by the Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins found sexual harassment to be prevalent and pervasive in Australian workplaces. Shortly after receiving the report in 2020, COVID-19 struck, and the government says that's the reason behind the delay. But a string of sexual harassment, assault and misconduct allegations in recent months have made it impossible to ignore.
The events around this building over the course of the past few months have only further highlighted and reinforced the seriousness of these issues, the challenge that we face.
Implementing some of the recommendations will require legislative changes, which Attorney General Michaelia Cash says she hopes to introduce to Parliament by June.
What we are going to doing and have accepted is to develop and implement a suite of legislative and regulatory reforms. Our aim is to reduce complexity, but also strengthen the national framework for addressing sexual harassment.
Among the changes, people will have 2 years instead of 6 months to raise a complaint with the Australian Human Rights Commission. Senator Cash says sexual harassment will also be added to the definition of serious misconduct, and the Fair Work Act will be amended to clarify that it is a valid reason for dismissal.
This will give employers the certainty they need to take action. But what it also says to employees and victims of sexual harassment is there are consequences for this action.
And the Sex Discrimination Act will be tweaked to clear up a grey area, ensuring that it applies to judges and members of Parliament.
We will be subject to the same law as anybody else, which means you will be subject to the same consequences.
Opposition frontbencher Christina Keneally is on board with that change, but says the government's roadmap is long overdue.
Labor welcomes some of the government's response to this report, but what we are quite clear about is we want to see the details, we want to see the funding, and we want to see the legislation.
Michelle O'Neill is the president of the Australian Council of Trade Unions and says the Prime Minister's response doesn't go far enough.
The government is showing they're prepared to look at legislation, but for some reason, the key measures that will really provide new rights to every worker in the country are the things that they've stepped away from in their response today.
Michelle O'Neill says on some fundamental recommendations, the government has failed to act. One of her concerns is the government's decision not to create a stop sexual harassment order in the Fair Work Act.
And this is one of the key things that lets down people who have been sexually harassed today in Australia. You can't get quick, easy access to justice. And instead of accepting that recommendation, the government has suggested a small change to adding sexual harassment to bullying orders. That will not go far enough.
President of the Australian Council of Trade Unions, Michelle O'Neill, Noor Haidar reporting. Well, when the Prime Minister fronted the media today on the Respect at Work report, he repeated another idea he's mentioned a few times now about women's experiences. He said that social media has the most corrosive impact on draining the reservoir of respect in our society. But those who've been around longer than social media note that harassment and abuse, in other words, active disrespect, were around long before Twitter and TikTok. Indeed, for some, social media's given women new audiences to rally together for change. Alexia Atwood reports.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison's been at pains to explain that he's heard the concerns of women across Australia. In announcing government action to try and stop sexual harassment and abuse at work, he stressed the problem starts with disrespect, and he has a culprit in mind.
We've got to be careful in our society that we don't allow the reservoir of respect to drain. And I fear it is. I genuinely fear that the reservoir of respect and the way we deal with each other and speak to each other is draining. I think social media has the most corrosive impact on that behaviour.
Women with experiences like Ginger Gorman took notice.
I became a predator trolling victim back in 2013 as a result of a story that I had written and broadcast. And as a result of that story, myself and my family became the targets of an orchestrated online hate campaign in which there were death threats against myself and my family.
And while Ginger Gorman, who's the author of the book Troll Hunting, has a deep understanding of the perils of social media, she also took issue with the Prime Minister's views.
Social media did not create sadism or bigotry. It exists in society. And yes, it is a vehicle for the proliferation of those ideas, but those ideas are already in our boardrooms and our bedrooms. He has a minister, for example, that called someone who is alleging rape in Parliament House a lying cow.
Feminist Jane Carrow says a lack of respect for women was around long before people had Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Before there was social media and you said to colleagues at work, my God, the boss just said this, that and the next thing to me, they'd go, oh, you're exaggerating. He didn't say that. Of course he didn't. But social media makes us see.
Jane Carrow credits social media with enabling women to demand respect and organise events like the women's marches. She says although the marches created political problems for the Prime Minister, they also helped draw out the changes the government announced today.
At least on social media, we've been able to band together and support one another, which was much harder to do prior to its emergence. We're actually demanding the respect we've never had before, and we're demanding it in large numbers. And you're hearing our voices in large numbers, yes, in those marches and things, all of which were organised on social media. So to demonise social media because it's presented him with a problem is deeply convenient.
Belinda Barnett is a social media expert from Swinburne University.
But certainly we need to regulate the platforms more and we need to take some action around harassment and trolling of women online. However, it has not caused the situation that we find ourselves in.
A recently tabled Federal Parliamentary Committee report recommended Australians present 100 points of identification before being allowed to post on social media in a bid to try and reduce online abuse. Belinda Barnett says the idea won't work.
Then there's no research behind it, and then you have the additional problems of the fact that Facebook has had numerous data breaches and has shown time and again that it really cannot look after our personal data. So it's not the right place to have custody of our arguably most sensitive documents, our identification documents.
Today's discussion also comes as a team of University of New South Wales researchers released a new study showing there is a strong relationship between the geographic locations from which misogynistic tweets are sent and the areas with the highest number of domestic violence arrests. Here's Professor Tom Denson from UNSW's School of Psychology, who's behind the study.
The technology is enabling them to have a wider audience and send their message of hatred out there. But in terms of the opposite can also happen, right? So if we have a respectful online culture, then we know people know that that's how you should behave online.
Professor Tom Denson from the University of New South Wales speaking with Alexia Atwood. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the ABC Listen app, and you can get us on the podcast as well. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, the pandemic slowed the world down, but barely slowed our rising carbon emissions.
It's been at least 3 million years and maybe a lot longer since the carbon dioxide levels were ever that high in the past. So we're moving into uncharted territory, and worst of all, we're moving faster than ever.
Imagine 20,000 foreign armed troops turning up at your border without notice one day. Alarming, most likely, especially when the troops belong to a nation that's already fought a war in and annexed part of your country. That's what Russia has been doing on the border with Ukraine in recent weeks, sparking speculation Moscow plans a spring invasion. Those heavily armed troops come on top of the almost 30,000 Russian military personnel already based on the Crimean Peninsula, which Russia annexed in 2014, all over Ukraine's determination to be democratic and to join the NATO military alliance. A former commander of US Army Europe, retired Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, is warning he believes Russia wants to command an enormous swathe of territory that'll have serious consequences for the West. I asked him first, though, about Moscow's claim that these latest movements are just routine exercises.
Well, there's nothing routine about this, except for the fact that this is how the Russians put pressure on Ukraine and their other neighbors to demonstrate their capability. Now, probably, I don't know this for a fact, but probably this will be ticked off as an exercise, and they'll continue on their way towards their Zapad exercise areas in the coming weeks. But that's the problem. The Russians do so many of these things right on the border, which is a violation of the Vienna documents in terms of transparency. They do it so much that everybody starts to get kind of numb to it, and then they've created the potential for doing something more than just an exercise.
And so where does that land? I mean, presumably the Russians are going to continue with this pattern of behaviour if somebody doesn't step up. And so what should that step up look like?
Yeah, well, you've nailed it. They know that the West does nothing. I mean, there's been some sanctions and people shaking their fists, but in truth, nothing serious has happened at all. And so they'll continue to do this and scoff at anybody talking about Ukrainian sovereignty, because the last thing the Kremlin wants is a Ukraine that's prosperous, stable, secure, and oriented towards the West. Same thing with Georgia, same thing with Transnistria, and for sure, same thing with Belarus. I believe, and obviously I hope I'm wrong, but I believe that their ultimate objective is to completely isolate Ukraine from the Black Sea so that they'll continue to take land, expand what they have in Crimea. There's some speculation about a possible movement to seize this canal that brings water from the Dnieper River down into Crimea because of a severe water crisis in Crimea. And that really would be not because they care about water, but that would be a step closer to Odessa. And I think Odessa is the ultimate objective, that then the entire Black Sea coast of Ukraine would be Russian-controlled.
So why does it matter?
It matters on three different levels. First, for the United States and our allies, this is an area that is the only east-west economic corridor between Eurasia and Europe that doesn't go through Russia or Iran. And so the economic growth of the countries around the Black Sea and in the Balkans would be significantly enhanced if this area was secure. Number two, Turkey, a very, very important NATO ally, but also particularly under the Erdogan administration, they have really been difficult to deal with. But if you have a Black Sea strategy, then we can fix that very important relationship that is an important bulwark against Iran. And then finally, we have NATO allies that are on the periphery of Ukraine and Russia. And if we, the United States, and we, NATO, don't hold the Russians accountable, what's to stop them from just continuing to threaten and destabilize countries on their periphery? So that's why this matters.
Do you think Europe and Washington are possessed of that, the need to act rather urgently on this?
I think the United States is, partly because President Biden specifically said that Ukrainian sovereignty is a priority. I am very disappointed. I live here in Frankfurt, Germany. I am very disappointed in Berlin and in Paris pathetic response when you see the French foreign ministries calling on both sides to de-escalate. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, Russia has invaded Ukraine, and so why would Paris call on the Ukrainians to de-escalate when it's the Russians that have thousands of troops sitting in Ukrainian sovereign territory? The United States has got to work with those critical allies, making it very clear that Ukraine's sovereignty, not only is that a policy statement, but we're going to put some serious effect behind that policy statement in terms of economic aid, diplomatic aid, and military aid.
Ben Hodges, good to have your analysis today. Thanks very much for your time.
It was a real pleasure, Linda. Thank you for what you're doing.
Retired US Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, who is now the Pershing Chair in Strategic Studies at the Centre for European Policy Analysis. More of that interview at the PM webpage. Now, the world's carbon footprint managed to grow again despite the global slowdown caused by the pandemic. Carbon dioxide levels are now at alarming record levels, the highest they've been in more than, wait for it, 3 million years. And those record levels are predicted to be broken again and again unless radical steps are taken to decarbonise the economy through technological change. Emily Burke reports.
As far as records go, it's not one the world can be proud of breaking. For the first time in recorded history, the concentration of atmospheric carbon dioxide has surged past more than 420 parts per million. Those levels are 50% above what they were when the Industrial Revolution began.
It's been at least 3 million years and maybe a lot longer since the carbon dioxide levels were ever that high in the past. So we're moving into uncharted territory, and worst of all, we're moving faster than ever.
Dr. Ralph Keeling is a geochemist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, which released the data. The implications are profound, he says. Carbon dioxide is the most abundant greenhouse gas. It traps heat. And more carbon dioxide in the air means more heat for the planet.
I look at the generations ahead and I say, wow, there are going to be some real challenges out there. Challenges relate to populations moving and economic impacts of climate change, direct threats to human health and safety, catastrophic storms, fires. I mean, a lot of that's already touching us in some ways.
Professor Stephen Sherwood is from the Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales.
What needs to happen is that human activities around the world that are emitting carbon dioxide need to scale back substantially. So if you could cut that globally to about half of what it is now, that would be enough to stop the carbon dioxide from increasing. But then over the long term, you'd have to eliminate almost all of our current emissions to keep the climate basically stabilized where it is now.
Is it surprising that the pandemic has had no effect on levels?
No, it's not surprising. The global energy use only dropped by something like 10%. And that's not enough. The Earth doesn't really care too much about that. That's the same as going back a couple decades ago. It's not a major change.
Professor Leah Stokes from the University of California is an expert on energy, climate and environmental politics.
I think we're all seeing the limits of, you know, staying home and not flying and maybe eating locally. But I believe it is government action that is very necessary. None of us can choose to unilaterally live in a low carbon society that isn't polluting. We're all locked into a system that has a lot of carbon pollution.
Dr. Pep Cannadel is executive director of the Global Carbon Project.
The biggest surprise was the fact that, you know, we shut down half of the global economy, yet we're still emitting so much, which says so much about how our society is ingrained into the use and consumption of fossil fuels. So we're not saying we need to do less. We're saying that whatever we do, it has to be done with renewable energies, not with fossil fuel energies. And that's the big thing.
And yet, he's optimistic.
I would say yes. For the first time in the last 25 years of international negotiations on climate change and discussing what we need to do, the only thing that has happened is that emissions have continued to fall. Up and up, up and up. And I think that this year, for the first time, we've seen the major emitters in the world, which is really important, really making very serious commitments to reach net zero emissions. Net zero emissions is exactly what we need to do. The biggest emitters are making these commitments. And I'm positive that others around the world, including Australia, will follow.
Dr. Pep Cannadel is Executive Director of the Global Carbon Project. Emily Burke with that report. I'm Linda Mottram, and that is PM. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Until next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
Australia's coal-fired power plants are on borrowed time, and the next one in line for closure is Liddell in New South Wales. This month marks the deadline the federal government gave the energy industry to make a plan for a world without it. So has the industry filled the gap?
Today on The Signal, is the Liddell closure going to cause blackouts and price spikes, or will it be relatively smooth sailing? And what happens when the next coal-fired power station shuts? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.